contacted State Police Lieutenant Gillen. Walter Steele hadn't invited Denise to participate either. For some reason, they are not desirous to get me into the case at all, and I can't understand why. With newspaper reports indicating other charges could be brought in the case, it would seem to me the more manpower the better, Denise said. It is an extraordinary investigation, and unusual. They are in the position where, if the case begins to crumble, people will start talking. By his attack on Edgartown authorities, Denise was hoping to deflect criticism about his office remaining aloof from the case. Denise had shown no eagerness to become involved. In fact, Denise protested that he wouldn't step into the Kennedy accident case unless specifically asked to do so by Edgartown authorities. That Denise had known about Senator Kennedy's involvement in the accident by noon on Saturday, and not called for an autopsy, was defended by Assistant District Attorney Armand Fernandez. You're saying that since Denise was factually aware at noon, that he was legally aware for purpose of intervening? I say no, no, no. You're saying he was supposed to change his opinion right away in Senator Kennedy's case, whereas with Joe Blow he wouldn't. Denise's office announced the district attorney would not be available for any further comment on this matter. That it was not customary for the district attorney's office to become involved in motor vehicle accidents came as news to Jimmy Smith. In February, Smith had tried a hit-and-run accident on a direct indictment for involuntary manslaughter. I got hung with it because the guy involved was a New Bedford fireman and a former high school star athlete, Smith said. No other assistant wanted the case. It was kicking around the office waiting to be tried for months. The lack of information about the Kennedy accident was deeply troubling, Denise said, when he called Smith to complain of the inept handling of the situation by the senator and his advisors. Where's all this Kennedy expertise? Where are all the pros? Can you imagine them just letting this thing ride? Smith could only agree. With nothing coming out of the compound, Denise's position was growing untenable. Smith wasn't concerned about the district attorney's office entering the case, so much as the political time bomb of no action on this thing. The beauty of the Kennedys earlier was that they acted. They didn't react. But this was a non-action. All they had to do was come up with some answers. The longer it waited, and they couldn't, the worse it got. The whole reaction of the parties was creating the suspense and mystery about the accident, whether it was intentional or not, Smith told Warren O'Donnell. O'Donnell was grim. Because of what was going on at Hyannisport, Smith said later. Because Kenneth was being frozen out. They were giving out his name as being there as an advisor to make it look like all the old Kennedy hands were rallying around, hoping that meant to people that Teddy couldn't be guilty of anything serious. But that wasn't working at all. O'Donnell thought Ted Kennedy was screwing up by delaying a public explanation of the accident. He had had direct experience with an earlier and notorious occasion, when Ted had gotten himself in trouble. O'Donnell had arranged for his Harvard roommate, Bill Freight, to take a Spanish examination in Kennedy's stead. When Freight got caught, he and Ted Kennedy had been expelled for cheating. Warren called his brother. In the midst of preparing John Kennedy's campaign against Henry Cabot Lodge, Kenneth O'Donnell told Ted Kennedy to pack his bags, but not to leave the dormitory until he received further instructions. When the telephone rang, Warren recognized the voice demanding to speak to Ted as former Ambassador Joseph P. Kennedy. You're in the Army. Report to Fort Dix at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, the ambassador announced and hung up. O'Donnell swore it was the real story of the famous cheating episode. Ted Kennedy had denied there was anything unusual about his interrupted education at Harvard. The Korean War was on, and he thought it was a good time to get my service over. Kennedy had served as an infantryman assigned to military police honor guard at SHAPE headquarters in Paris. A curtain of secrecy had enveloped the incident until 1962, when Boston Globe reporter Robert Healy discovered the story. Kenneth O'Donnell had participated in White House conferences seeking to persuade Healy not to release the information as a news story. A compromise had allowed Ted Kennedy to confess the incident, with a statement of contrition. The public had been forgiving of the schoolboy prank, and the incident was diffused as an issue in the election. That wasn't going to be possible with the accident at Chappaquiddick, Warren O'Donnell said. Jack wasn't in the White House, and Bobby was dead. Whatever happened at Chappaquiddick was bound to come out. Attempts to manage the crisis were so blatant, nobody was going to believe anything but a complete disclosure. Smith was worried the pressure on the district attorney's office was starting to tell. Reluctant as Denise was to do anything, Smith said, he can't duck the case forever. On Thursday morning, now 6 days after the accident, Denise called Dr. Donald Mills to ask, I don't think an autopsy was necessary, do you? Surprised to hear Denise mention autopsy for the first time, Mills said, I really agree. I'm sticking to my guns on that. Mills wanted the district attorney's office to issue an official statement about the accident. That way, he would be spared having to reiterate the known facts of the case to reporters who were continuing to pester him about the lack of an autopsy and Mary Jo Kopechne's blood alcohol test figure. Denise was staying out of the case, he said. I don't want another Lee Harvey Oswald affair. If I get involved, it's going to stir up a big Roman holiday in Edgartown. We don't want that, so we let Arena handle it. Under pressure from reporters, Mills released the blood alcohol test figure of 0.09%. He characterized it as a very modest, very slight level of alcohol in Mary Jo Kopechne's blood, an interpretation that immediately was challenged by other medical authorities. The test had been conducted by Dr. John McHugh, director of the State Police Chemistry Lab in Boston. McHugh said, in this particular case, the figure means a person weighing 110 pounds or thereabouts has an alcohol intake of about 3.75 to 5 ounces of 80 to 90 proof liquor. That's up to 5 drinks within 1 hour prior to death. More if you measure over a longer period, since alcohol diminishes in the bloodstream with the passage of time. The standard of interpreting blood alcohol in terms of human behavior demonstrated a figure of 0.09% was at a level which adversely affected driving. All European countries and Canada established 0.08% as the point which a person should not operate an automobile. Massachusetts provided 0.15% as legal intoxication, but legislation was pending to conform Massachusetts to the federal standard of 0.10%. According to existing statutory guidelines, a test result of 0.05% was presumption of sobriety. With percentages of more than 0.05%, but less than 0.15%, there shall be no presumption, McHugh said. Mary Jo Kopechne may not have been legally intoxicated by Massachusetts standards, but she was closer to drunk than sober when she died. Plagued by the return of reporters to his office and the eruption of another medical controversy about his role in the accident, Dr. Mills announced a press conference for Friday morning. Chief Arena canceled the Thursday morning press briefing. The Federated Church Parish Hall was booked for the annual Whale of a Sale Bazaar. Arena was now suffering a different species of pressure than he had from reporters. Massachusetts Attorney General Robert Quinn had called to say, Chief, you're talking too much. Quinn suggested Arena cancel all further press briefings. Identified as an aide to George Killen, Bernie Flynn announced from Barnstable Courthouse, pretrial publicity has gotten to the stage that it's unconstitutional. Killen sincerely hoped Arena was keeping in mind some of the recent Supreme Court decisions, particularly those bearing on pretrial publicity. The two press conferences a day were driving Killen crazy, Flynn said. It got so bad, I told Arena myself, for Christ's sake, take it easy. He'd say, oh, all right, I'll knock it off. Then an hour later, he'd be going at it again. You couldn't control the guy as far as the press was concerned. Arena was in such thrall to reporters. If they stuck a potato in front of him, he'd talk into it like it was a microphone. Killen was appalled at the escalation of the publicity in the case since Arena's briefings. Every time you turned on the television, there's his mug making exculpatory statements about there not being any negligence in the accident, giving his whole goddamn case away. Arena should not be revealing details of his investigation, like a detective reporting his progress to a superior officer, Killen said. There was no prosecutable case left except for leaving the scene. And if Arena didn't mind his public statements, he could very well lose that one, too. Killen asked his friend Al Hinckley, chief of Barnstable Police, to call Arena about talking to reporters about his prosecution of Ted Kennedy. Hinckley did, telling Arena, "Better not blow your case." "I don't think I was told to shut up," Arena said. "There were some calls from law enforcement people informing me I was endangering my case, but those calls were made in goodwill. They were friendly calls." Arena sent Officer Robert Bregure to tell reporters gathered at the parish house for the afternoon's briefing, "There will be no further press conferences on the advisement of Special Prosecutor Walter Steele." Reporters regretted the end of the briefings, given the sobriquet, "The Walter and Dominic Show," by a Chicago Today reporter, and referred to less fondly by others as "Ted Mack's Original Amateur Hour." Arena and Steele might understandably have been awed at having to deal with a U.S. senator and a potential presidential candidate, and hesitated to question Ted Kennedy aggressively. But it is beyond belief entirely why answers, complete and satisfactory ones, to the obvious questions in this case have not been forthcoming voluntarily from those who participated in the events. The Nation complained. Many questions which should have been asked as a matter of course in circumstances such as these have not even been asked. No purpose had been served by the press briefings, except to afford Arena and Steele the opportunity to defend their maladroit handling of the case. Arena had tried to make up for his lack of investigation by talking a lot, one observer noted. The more he talked, the more he invited ridicule from reporters for knowing so little. Yet Arena had won over the press by an unflagging good humor. He'd initialed scores of personal checks so reporters could get them cashed. No small accomplishment in tourist-wary Edgartown. Refereed the repeated squabbles for territorial space between rival television correspondents, Ben Silver and Liz Trotta, and never refused a reasonable request for information, such as he was able to provide. Selectman Robert Carroll chose the occasion of the canceled news briefings to declare his complete satisfaction with Arena's handling of the Kennedy accident. "He is not only the best chief this town has ever had, but one of the best in the country," Carroll said. "Unlike the district attorney, our chief is not looking for headlines to further his own career." A gratuitous swipe at Denise, given the district attorney's obvious reluctance to involve himself in the case. But Carroll's encomiums had fallen short of the mark. Arena had been duped about the party by Senator Kennedy, then had failed to press Kennedy on his promise to provide more information about the accident. He'd been deprived of important license information by the registry, and straight-armed by Killen, then been persuaded by Walter Steele into filing the least charge possible in a fatal automobile accident. Arena himself had come up with no evidence, except that provided by the senator's report, and Huck Look's volunteered testimony, which contradicted it with regard to the time the accident had occurred and the reason for the senator's wrong turn on Dyke Road. Nor had Arena corroborated either version. As Ted Kennedy's leading supporter in Edgartown, Carroll was only confirming what reporters knew already. The great job Arena had done absolving Ted Kennedy of any blame for the death of Mary Jo Kopechne. Chapter 28. But Arena was, finally, going to question Jack Crimmins, one of the guests at the Chappaquiddick party. Accompanied by Walter Steele and Tommy Teller, Arena drove to the registry office at Oak Bluffs to meet Registry Inspector Red Kennedy. There, they boarded Kennedy's cabin cruiser for the 10-mile journey across Vineyard Sound to Falmouth, and their rendezvous with Jack Crimmins. Crimmins met the delegation at the door of his room at the Catamaran Motel. A tall man with coarse skin, he was the fastidiously dressed bachelor who liked to hang around cops, Arena had known from his state trooper days at Suffolk County Courthouse. Crimmins was then employed as a legal aide and investigator in the district attorney's office. Arena wasn't sure what Crimmins did. Jack was one of those typical hail-fellow-well-met Irish guys who probably wouldn't have to work a day in his life on a strenuous job because of these little things that kept coming up. Arena figured Crimmins to be the beneficiary of a no-heavy-lifting patronage sinecure, favored by Massachusetts politicians. Arena regretted not having spoken to Kennedy's chauffeur on Saturday morning, he said. I thought, gee, that would have been a great feather in my own cap, because right from the beginning I might have had an idea what the hell had gone on the night before. Crimmins had come to the police station to talk to Arena, but spotted a Newsweek reporter in the corridor he didn't like and left. Crimmins was now suspiciously eager to cooperate. 5 days of dealing with reporters had rubbed some skepticism off on Arena. He wondered if Crimmins didn't have another purpose in mind, he said. Here's a guy who's going to say we've got the interview with him, so we don't have to bother anyone else who was at the party. Arena asked Crimmins, what can you tell us about the night of the accident? Do you mind if I write it? Crimmins said. A statement was better than an interrogation, in Arena's opinion. So we all stood around like Joe Bananas, gabbing, while Jack wrote out his statement in longhand. My name is John B. Crimmins. I live at 164 Marine Road, South Boston. On July 18, 1969, I was on Chappaquiddick at a cottage rented by Joseph Gargan, where a cookout was held for girls who had worked for Robert Kennedy in his presidential campaign. There were 12 people present. Myself, Senator Kennedy, Paul Markham, Charles Tretter, Joe Gargan, Ray LaRosa, the deceased, Susan Tannenbaum, Rosemary Keough, Esther Newberg, Mary Ellen, and Nancy Lyons. It was a friendly party. The group was reminiscing and discussing politics. There was liquor available for those who wanted it. We all ate between 9:30 p.m. and 10:30 p.m. as the steaks came off the grill. Joe Gargan prepared and served frozen hors d'oeuvres until the steaks were ready. At about 11:15 p.m., Senator Kennedy asked me for the keys to the car so he could get back to Edgartown. I talked briefly with him at this time. He was perfectly normal at that time. There was nothing unusual about his appearance or behavior. Immediately thereafter, the car pulled away from the front of the house. Sometime later, I went to bed in the cottage. I first learned of the accident the following morning. Arena didn't ask Crimmins why he hadn't driven the senator to the ferry, how much Kennedy had to drink at the party, what time the senator had returned to the cottage after the accident, and why Crimmins hadn't been told about it until the next morning. Arena's new reticence about making public statements about the case prevented him from revealing he had at last questioned one of the partygoers, one of the most embarrassing holes in his threadbare investigation. To have released the statement would have been asking for trouble. The Crimmins interview was a transparent effort to allay suspicion that the party had been a riotous affair. Even Arena recognized the effort to absolve the senator of any blame, he said. The statement certainly seemed to be one that would cover everything. Here's somebody who was at the party saying, it was a nice time, everybody was sociable. In other words, he's corroborating Ted Kennedy. Arena had copies of the Crimmins statement delivered to Dick McCarran's office. McCarran had just received a telephone call from Clark, asking him to draft a statement waiving the senator's right to a hearing to contest Arena's complaint application. McCarran read the two paragraphs over the telephone to Stephen Smith at the compound. Smith turned him over to Ted Sorensen. Sorensen made two minor changes in the text. Then the statement was held pending further developments. The decision to withdraw objections to the complaint had been worked out at a major conference at the compound, giving rise to rumors that the long-awaited statement about the accident was forthcoming. The conferences were the target of such scathing press criticism that it was plain the senator's decision could wait no longer. The New York Times reacted sharply to the picture of Senator Kennedy locking himself up in his Hyannisport compound for a solid week with high-powered advisors. This, the newspaper said, reinforces the suspicions aroused by his failure to report the accident until after he had conferred or tried to confer with a battery of lawyers, that his priority interest from the moment of the accident was to avoid assumption of responsibility for the tragic situation. To the Chicago Daily News, Kennedy's almost Pavlovian response to the accident had been a flight to the seemingly safe world of advisors and public relations experts. Their presence alone had changed the whole scale of the event. The compound planning sessions were like a parody of the Cuban Missile Crisis, life said. All the surviving New Frontiersmen scheming to extract their man from the scandal of an accident. All they had to account for was the classic rich kid's stunt, running away from an accident that Dad can fix with the judge. Even Clark was unhappy with the resolution. Reputations such as his were not made by pleading clients guilty. The solution proposed by Hanafy, seconded by Stephen Smith, and agreed to by the senator as a way of throwing a bone to prosecuting authorities and not dragging the case out. It's what lawyers traditionally do, Dick McCarron agreed. Plead to a lesser charge in hopes of avoiding a more serious one. Clark arranged to go to Edgartown on a chartered plane to work out the details of Kennedy's court appearance with Arena and Steele. Arena wasn't prepared for another meeting. We didn't get much advance notice. I didn't know what to expect, if it was going to be a pitch or what. Arena agreed to meet Clark in a vacant office at Martha's Vineyard Airport. It was at this meeting, he said, they threw the bomb at us. Senator Kennedy was going to waive the hearing and face arraignment on the charge of leaving the scene. Clark said, how would you feel about pleading guilty and asking for probation? Copping a plea was fine with Steele, but he thought the idea of a United States senator on probation was absurd. Clark proposed a plea and a suspended sentence. McCarron would make a statement on mitigation and hope Judge Boyle would go for it. Clark wanted to move quickly. There were security problems to be considered. The senator's staff feared that a crank might be lurking about Edgartown, so inflamed by the controversy over the accident as to do injury to the senator. Extraordinary measures would have to be taken to protect Ted Kennedy. Clark proposed going to court, first thing in the morning. We'll waive our rights to a hearing, make our plea, and get the hell out before anybody knows what's happening. The idea made sense to Arena, provided he could arrange police protection that fast. Before Clark flew back to Hyannis, another pre-arraignment meeting was agreed upon, to coordinate the senator's court appearance. Arena was calling in reinforcements from other island police forces when Walter Steele burst into the police station. He said, Jesus, we forgot to tell the judge. Steele called court clerk Tommy Teller. No cases were docketed for the next morning. Boyle wasn't scheduled to hold court. The judge was off island, visiting relatives in New Bedford, not due to return until evening. Boyle refused to discuss the matter over the phone when Teller called him. He didn't sound much taken with the idea of arraigning Senator Kennedy the next morning. Boyle said, why should we put the case down for any date they ask for? That's when we all pushed the panic button, Arena recalled, when Tommy said we better not do anything without Boyle's approval, because he'll get upset. Arena and Steele went to Dick McCarron's house. McCarron scrambled some eggs, but nobody was hungry. McCarron left for the airport to meet Judge Clark. Steele and Arena went to Ocean Heights. Arena had a cold drink before Clark arrived with two copies of the operator's report of the accident and confirmation that arrangements for the next day's court appearance had been made at the Kennedy end. Steele gave Clark the bad news. We don't know if Judge Boyle will be sitting tomorrow. Steele was leaving for a meeting with Boyle in Vineyard Haven. He instructed the others to stay clear of the uncurtained windows and to keep quiet should anyone come to the door. If reporters learned the senator's lawyers were meeting secretly with the chief of police and county prosecutor, it would be on the news wires in an hour that a deal was being cooked up. Clark asked Arena what he would do if Senator Kennedy pleaded guilty. Arena would give the normal summary of the facts of the case like I usually do. Would you mind putting it together now? Clark asked. Arena went into another room. He used Steele's typewriter to bang out a statement. I was very pleased my initial preparation was acceptable to all, he said later. That was word for word the testimony I gave the next morning in court. Arena waited for Steele to return as twilight fell. A lot of time went by. We were all wondering what the hell was happening. A voice boomed from outdoors calling Walter Steele. Arena observed a large man of unmistakable albino complexion, placing planks across the back porch steps from a panel truck backed into the driveway. Irina told Clark and McCarran to hide in a bedroom. He opened the door and greeted Bill McClure.
"I brought Walter's refrigerator," McClure said.
"Go right ahead," Irina said. He thought it was pretty funny that in the middle of a secret meeting some guy shows up to deliver a refrigerator. I'm trying to be so coy, making small talk, and this guy is probably wondering, where did all these cars come from? Who do they belong to? Steele returned around 9 o'clock with good news. Boyle would hear the case first thing in the morning. Although it would undermine security arrangements, it was decided to hold a press conference to announce the senator's arraignment. There was no way Ted Kennedy could be sneaked in and out of Edgartown District Court to make his plea. Irina sent his officers to hotels and popular drinking spots in Edgartown, rounding up as many reporters as possible. McCarran planned to deliver the statement he'd written, but developed last-minute stage fright. Judge Clark did it instead. He said, "I've got a brief announcement to make. I cannot elaborate on it. This is it. I can say no more." Senator Kennedy was waiving his objection to the issuance of a complaint against him. He would accept service on the charge of leaving the scene tomorrow morning in district court. Kennedy's decision to face arraignment came as a complete surprise, Irina told reporters. "I have no idea what they based their decision on. As of this moment, there is nothing to indicate this is more than a motor vehicles case." If Kennedy pleaded guilty, Irina was prepared to present his case. "If a not guilty plea is entered, we'll ask for a continuance." Irina didn't think Steele was prepared to prosecute. Steele promptly and predictably contradicted him. "I'm ready to go to court, I tell you. I have the witnesses ready." Steele was asked about a report of the accident filed with the Registry of Motor Vehicles, in which Senator Kennedy was purported to have been driving so carefully he could not have been negligent when the car went over Dyke Bridge. Steele confirmed a report had been filed, but refused to show it. Reminded such documents were routinely made available to the press, Steele said, "That's right, they are. But this one isn't. So sue me." When the reporter wanted to know if Steele had served as an assistant district attorney for Suffolk County with Ted Kennedy in 1961, and what their relationship was, Steele exploded, "That's true. And if you're going to ask questions like that, you can leave. In fact, I'll have you shown out." Steele ordered 2 Edgartown police officers, "Take him out." The prosecutor had cooled down by the time reporters submitted their names and affiliations, in the hope of being assigned to a 35-member press pool allowed inside the courtroom to cover the arraignment. Harvey Ewing and Colbert Smith would be admitted without question, Steele said, because they represent the local press. Steele sat up until 3 a.m. selecting the press pool and preparing his appearance in court for the next morning. After the press conference, Clark called reporter Joe Donegan in Brockton, Massachusetts. District courts did not provide verbatim transcription of proceedings. Donegan understood why Clark wanted Ted Kennedy's arraignment taken the next morning. If a lawyer had a serious case in the district court, he'd always get a stenographer to have a permanent record, Donegan said. What they want that for is to study the Commonwealth's case to prepare their defense for a superior court trial, if there is one. Usually the defense doesn't put on a case in the district court. They just let the Commonwealth put their case on, then rest. Especially if they know there's a strong case against their client. Donegan agreed to be in Edgartown the next morning. At his office, Richard McCarran received a telephone call from Joe Gargan to go to Oak Bluffs to await the arrival of attorney John Driscoll. Gargan had suggested Driscoll be sent to Edgartown, not as a legal advisor, but to coordinate the senator's appearance the next morning, the arrival of the other lawyers, and the going to court. Gargan usually did this kind of advance work, but he was out of favor insofar as Kennedy's staff was concerned. In addition, nobody wanted Gargan, the co-host of the party at Chappaquiddick, and a key witness who had thus far avoided interrogation by police, on conspicuous view the morning Ted Kennedy made his plea. Because it was late when this was decided, Gargan suggested Driscoll go over on the Kennedy yacht, Marlin. The boat was on call at all times for any kind of trip, Gargan said, so it wasn't difficult to make arrangements. Gargan accompanied Driscoll on the voyage across Vineyard Sound. He did not talk about the accident with him. I never discussed the accident with Jack Driscoll, he said, or anyone else for that matter. McCarran recalled the Marlin coming out of the darkness, like some mystery ship. Driscoll was dropped off at the dock. He wanted to check the route Kennedy was to travel to the courthouse the next morning, but it was too foggy. McCarran put him up for the night in an apartment in a building he owned on Edgartown's Main Street. Driscoll roused McCarran very early the next morning in order to review security arrangements made in advance of Kennedy's court appearance. Edgartown was shrouded in gray mist and uncomfortably warm when Arena walked to town hall at 8 a.m. Police in foul weather gear were directing traffic on Main Street. Arena had brought in reinforcements from other police departments to provide what security he could. But the number of newsmen gathering in front of the courthouse and the tiers of television cameras ranked across the street made him uneasy. It was impossible to provide absolute protection for Ted Kennedy without closing off Main Street altogether. Senator Kennedy, his wife, and Stephen Smith boarded the Marlin at Hyannisport for the hour-long crossing through fog and heavy seas to Martha's Vineyard. McCarran met his client for the first time when the Marlin docked at Oak Bluffs. Kennedy looked grim and tense. He wore a blue suit and a dark tie, but had left his cervical collar at home. A detachment of state police escorted him to Edgartown. Chapter 29. When Kennedy entered the courthouse, Arena presented him with a forthwith summons, making his appearance in court official. The senator was taken to the probation office to fill out an identity card required of all defendants. Then, he met privately in a second-floor grand jury room with Clark and McCarran. Clark had received no assurance Judge Boyle would go along with a suspended sentence. "I never had a case like it," Clark said later. "I didn't know a single thing about that judge, and I didn't know what he was going to do. He could have sent my client to jail." McCarran was concerned about the mandatory 20-day jail term in all cases of leaving the scene of an accident where personal injury had occurred. Boyle was a stickler for strict construction of statutory commandments when it came to sentencing. Kennedy tried to put McCarran at ease, telling him, "Don't worry about it. He's already made up his mind." Boyle wasn't likely to make a precipitous decision from the bench. McCarran entered the courtroom first, followed by Ted Kennedy. All eyes observed the senator walk slowly to a captain's chair in the row of seats behind the defendant's table. Kennedy clasped his hands together, rested his chin on his fingers, and stared at the floor. Seated at a table reserved for local press in the courtroom, Harvey Ewing contrasted the fast-stepping Kennedy he photographed on Saturday morning with the beaten man in the courtroom. "Kennedy looked whipped," Ewing said. "He looked like there's one senator that should have gone down with the car." The Methodist church bell next door tolled the hour, although the electric clock in the courtroom read 8:58 a.m. Kennedy flinched when a bailiff banged a gavel for quiet and intoned, "The District Court of the County of Dukes County is now in session. God save the Commonwealth of Massachusetts." Judge James Boyle entered the courtroom. A tall man with a thinning ridge of red hair, mustache, and ruddy complexion, Boyle settled himself behind a raised oak desk. Court clerk Tommy Teller called the first case on the docket. "Commonwealth versus Edward M. Kennedy. This complaint charges that Edward M. Kennedy of Boston, Mass., on the 19th day of July, 1969, at Edgartown, did operate a certain motor vehicle upon a public way in said Edgartown, and did go away after knowingly causing injury to Mary Jo Kopechne, without stopping and making known his name, residence, and the number of his motor vehicle." Teller addressed Kennedy directly. "How do you plead? Guilty or not guilty?" After 1 week of studied silence, closeted with advisors at Hyannisport, this was the climactic moment of truth reporters had been waiting for. Whether Kennedy would admit guilt or seek to defend himself from the charge. Kennedy hesitated. He looked at his attorneys. His lips moved, but no sound came. "Guilty," he said, in a choked near whisper, hardly audible. He swallowed hard, then repeated in a louder but shaking voice, "Guilty." As was his custom, Boyle wanted to hear a summary of the evidence. Arena was sworn. He received permission to read a précis of the case from personal notes written on a single sheet of yellow paper. Kennedy slumped in his chair, his eyes shut. Not once did he raise his head while Arena testified. Arena dropped his summary in mid-recital. He spent several seconds crouched on the floor of the witness stand retrieving the document. More than one reporter in the courtroom thought the incident symbolized Arena's handling of the case. McCarran had no questions of the officer. Boyle had a question. Peering over his glasses, he said in a harsh voice, "I would be most interested in determining from the defendant or the Commonwealth if there was a deliberate effort to conceal the identity of the defendant." The question encapsulated all speculation that Ted Kennedy had tried to avoid being implicated in Mary Jo Kopechne's death by delaying his report of the accident. Arena looked confused. "Identity of the defendant?" he asked. "Not to my knowledge, Your Honor." Steele stepped in. "Thank you, Chief," he said, getting Arena off the witness stand in a hurry. Boyle had addressed his question to the defendant or the Commonwealth. Senator Kennedy had chosen not to respond to the question. Everybody in the court knew only he could answer. Arena and Steele would have no idea what the senator had done after the accident. Boyle turned his attention to the defender's table. Clark and McCarran stiffened. If Boyle asked Ted Kennedy the question directly, he would be required to answer or plead the Fifth Amendment to avoid self-incrimination. Boyle let the question go. He said, "I should be glad to hear you gentlemen on disposition." It was an incredible gaffe. If Boyle wanted to find out what Kennedy had done in the hours after the accident, this was the time to do so. Unsettled by the close call, McCarran said, shakily, "The attorney's legal defenses that could be presented in this case..." Boyle cut him off. "I don't think that is a proper statement to make," he said sharply. "On a plea of guilty, that's a confession. I don't think you should argue there are legal defenses." Boyle was concerned now with the question of mitigating circumstances. He didn't want any public relations posturing in his court. Senator Kennedy was adamant in his wish to plead guilty, McCarran said. "It is his direction that his plea be entered and to leave the disposition to this court." In view of the defendant's attorneys, confinement of the defendant would not be the proper course. "I believe his character is well known to the world," McCarran said. "We would, therefore, ask that any sentence that the court may impose be suspended." Steele proposed incarceration in the Barnstable House of Correction for a period of 2 months. Having in mind the character of the defendant, his age and reputation prior to the accident, Steele said, "The ends of justice would best be served were he given a suspended sentence." Boyle asked Chief Probation Officer Helen Tyra, "There is no record?" Under a Charlottesville, Virginia dateline, the Associated Press had circulated a story appearing in that morning's newspapers, listing Ted Kennedy's record of previous traffic offenses. Apparently, Tyra hadn't read the papers. "None, Your Honor," she said. Boyle paused. The courtroom held its collective breath. Clark called it the longest minute of my life, waiting for the judge to announce his decision. "Considering the unblemished record of the defendant," Boyle said, "and insofar as the Commonwealth represents, this is not a case where he was really trying to conceal his identity." Steele interjected a firm, "No, sir." Where it was Boyle's understanding that Kennedy has already been and will continue to be punished far beyond anything this court can impose, the ends of justice would be satisfied by the imposition of the minimum jail sentence and suspension of that sentence, assuming the defendant accepts the suspension. McCarran wasted no time in saying, "The defendant will accept the suspension, Your Honor." Kennedy stood up. Teller said, "Edward M. Kennedy, on the complaint the court has found you guilty and has sentenced you to serve 2 months in the House of Correction at Barnstable. Sentence is suspended."
Boyle adjourned the court. The proceeding had taken 7 minutes. Kennedy, his wife, and Stephen Smith were led by 2 state troopers down a back staircase to the front of the courthouse. Kennedy paused on the top step to confront a corps of reporters shouting questions in a light drizzle. Kennedy ignored the questions. He said, "I have made my plea, and I have requested time on the networks tonight to speak to the people of Massachusetts and the nation." His last words were lost as the crowd surged forward, nearly knocking him to the ground. State troopers shouldered through the crowd to allow the senator to reach a car parked at the curbside, sparing him further contact with reporters. The car sped off to Martha's Vineyard Airport. A chartered airplane was waiting for the return flight to Hyannisport. Chapter 30. Anticipating the outrage of reporters expecting more facts coming out of the hearing, but having received no more than Arena's truncated version of the case, Steele, Teller, and Arena were engaged in a struggle inside the courthouse. Teller urged the police chief, "You go out and tell them it's all over." "Nobody else would go out. That's how I ended up in front of the television cameras again," Arena recalled. He told reporters, "We have prosecuted on the facts we have, and there are no additional facts warranting further investigation. I'm satisfied I did my job, and the case is closed." Arena thought the sentence had been fair. Any defendant with a clean record was entitled to a suspended sentence. He felt the most relief since Clark had mentioned a possible guilty plea, he said. "I thought of letting out a big yell. Hey, everybody, let's all go out to South Beach and go swimming or something. I honestly thought the whole thing would be over, that his speech would be the end of it." Arena returned to the police station, talked with reporters, and just tried to relax. CBS correspondent Ben Silver proposed coming to Arena's house to film the police chief watching the senator's broadcast. Arena did not think that was a very good idea. Silver returned to the station an hour later, Arena related. He said he'd called New York and been told he really had to do it. "It was at this time that I gently but firmly reminded him that I was the chief of police, and that if he or any of his people came on my property, I would arrest them for trespassing." Walter Steele thought justice had been done, telling reporters when he left the courthouse, "This case is closed." The haste with which the case had been disposed of, the appearance of a show trial, combined with a guilty plea that precluded cross-examination and the taking of evidence, smacked of a deal worked out in advance of Kennedy's court appearance. Steele allowed that he had held the customary discussions with defense attorneys, who informed him their client was considering a guilty plea. He said, "I let them know what my recommendation to the court for sentencing would be if such a plea were entered." Steele refused to speculate about the questions that remained unanswered about the accident. Presumably, Senator Kennedy would address those mysteries in his speech. "People think once you present a case to trial, you know everything," Steele said later. "You never do. There will always be doubts." Senator Kennedy had been urged to defend the charge against him, McCarran revealed. It was his decision and his decision alone to plead guilty. Had the jail sentence not been suspended, the senator would have appealed to the Superior Court for a trial by jury. "The adjudication of the case was justified and perfectly proper," McCarran said. "You had to enter a sentence, but you could suspend." The mandatory 20-day jail term he'd feared could be dispensed with, a view other legal authorities were beginning to challenge. Suspension of a mandatory sentence was not legal, George Killen's close friend, Falmouth attorney Frank Keating, said. The statute called for no less than 20 days in all cases. That meant if you gave any sentence at all, it's got to be a minimum 20 days in jail. You can't give 2 months, then suspend. The only way Boyle could have gotten around that was to give Senator Kennedy straight probation with no sentence at all. McCarran remained at the courthouse to deal with probation papers.
Helen Tyra intended to treat Senator Kennedy like all her other probationers, she said. I see no reason, and neither did he, why the senator would be any different. Kennedy's reporting dates were a private matter and, just like everyone else, reached on an individual basis. The senator had to report by letter, phone, or in person. Tyra refused to disclose how often she would require Kennedy to do so during his year's probation. Ordinarily, convicted persons were forbidden from leaving the court's jurisdiction, she said. But Senator Kennedy will be free to travel at will. Pestered by reporters for a copy of the transcript he had taken of the brief proceedings, court stenographer Joe Donegan started to cooperate, then thought better about it. As an employee of Senator Kennedy's lawyers, he wondered if he should provide reporters with access to the document. Donegan asked McCarran if it was all right. McCarran wasn't taking any chances. He called the compound in Hyannisport and received permission from Stephen Smith. Donegan figured that wrapped up his involvement in the Kennedy accident case. But he was to play a much more significant role as part of a daring effort to prevent any more information about the accident coming out than was available from the brief transcript of Kennedy's trial he had transcribed, or the speech the senator was scheduled to make that evening. Gwen Kopechne was looking forward to Senator Kennedy's broadcast, she said. I'm waiting for him to discuss his part publicly. There are a few things that happened that haven't been cleared up to the public yet. Mrs. Kopechne would take further action if Senator Kennedy did not clarify these points. I know there are a lot of sick people in the world, and maybe we should expect a little vicious mail. If we can't clear up all the little snide remarks and everything, I would have an autopsy performed, if that's the only way I can clear my daughter. Her only interest in the case was the light in which Mary Jo's character and background was being shown. The furor over the fact that an autopsy was not done was totally unfounded, Dr. Mills told a press conference 1 hour before Senator Kennedy's court appearance. Mills had consulted the district attorney's office. Although this call is not required of me, I made it because the case involved personalities of national importance, and it was altogether more than I wanted to carry without further advice. Lieutenant George Killen had sent word that if Mills was satisfied as to the cause of death, which I was, then he was satisfied to close the matter with my original finding. He said, "My feelings have not changed in this respect. Neither Lieutenant Killen nor I had the slightest inkling of Senator Kennedy's involvement in the case at the time. The decision not to autopsy was based on the facts at hand, and was, in effect, a joint decision between Lieutenant Killen and myself. On a strictly objective basis, we have no reason to regret this decision." Had the district attorney considered an autopsy after embalming advisable, Denise would have ordered it, Mills said. Certainly he knew of the Kennedy connection as soon as I did. Mills had been asked numerous times if an autopsy would have been ordered had he known Senator Kennedy was the driver of the accident car. "I believe," he said, "the district attorney's office would agree with me that the answer would be yes, in view of the senator's prominence as a national figure and the need to protect his public image against speculation." Had Mills known the extent of the senator's involvement, I would have told the district attorney's office an autopsy was needed. Not for medical reasons, mind you, but just to have avoided all this awful hue and cry about nothing, and to make sure the senator's name was cleared. In view of the clear-cut evidence of drowning, and the knowledge we had at the time, an autopsy was not indicated, and if done today would add absolutely nothing we do not already know. The public concept that an autopsy was the total and final answer to all circumstances surrounding a death was a myth, Mills said. I would urge the press to drop this angle once and for all. If Mills hoped the issue had been laid to rest, it wouldn't stay buried. An hour after his press conference, reporters had a story that Mrs. Kopechne was willing to have her daughter's body disinterred, if that would clear her reputation, Mills said. It was implied that I would have to initiate such a step, which I was perfectly willing to do. Mills called the district attorney's office in New Bedford to plead with assistant Armand Fernandez to send somebody down to help me. Fernandez
didn't know the law on the subject, he said. It was clear to Mills that he fervently wished me to take full responsibility for the no autopsy. The case disposed of in the district court, a most curious ritual occurred at the Registry of Motor Vehicles office in Hyannis. Judge Clark personally turned over Senator Kennedy's license to Registrar Richard McLaughlin. Where the license came from was neither explained nor questioned. The senator had not been able to produce a license at the police station, and David Burke had not found one in Kennedy's Washington car. The license was mailed to registry headquarters. That a license renewal had been found in the tab room aroused Inspector Joseph Molino's suspicions. When I learned it was Senator Kennedy's license I'd done the check on, I was surprised. Molino hadn't looked in the tab room, because I had a file card in my hand. I had no reason to look anywhere else. I didn't figure there was any other card, because after 5 months I wouldn't be looking for one. Anything I might find in the tab room couldn't be there more than 2 or 3 weeks, he said. I don't think it would have been in there at all. It seems funny as hell. Molino had been alone in the radio room when he checked Kennedy's license. He hadn't seen anyone in the building. But a while later, I heard talk going around that McLaughlin was there on Saturday night, he said. It wouldn't take much for someone to key punch a new license, to spare the senator the embarrassment of not having one. McLaughlin denied the senator's license had expired, then dismissed the issue as not relevant to an accident. The expiration of a license of a person who's had one for a long time is not an indication of his ability to operate a motor vehicle. That the license had expired, and that fact been concealed by the registry, was confirmed when Hank Jonah telephoned Assistant District Attorney Jimmy Smith. Jonah's friend, Joe Grealish, wanted Smith to know the problem with the senator's license had been taken care of. Gargan didn't know the senator was driving on an expired license at the time of the accident, but he wasn't surprised to learn later this had been the case. Jack Kennedy often drove with an expired license, and so did Bobby. That doesn't make it any better, of course. Ted probably just forgot to have his license renewed, Gargan said. Gargan had no idea why the senator should want to conceal the fact, or that Registrar McLaughlin should later claim Senator Kennedy's license never expired. McLaughlin claimed registry records showed Kennedy had applied for renewal on February 6, 1969. In fact, he made it right here in this building. We have girls downstairs who handle things like that, just like any registry office. Forgetful of the senator's 2 charges of driving without a license in Virginia, McLaughlin added, he was always prompt in renewing his license. Kennedy had been in Massachusetts on February 6th. He had followed an early morning appearance in Quincy with trips to Taunton, Fall River, and New Bedford. Kennedy's Boston office had advanced the 3-day brainstorming tour. Gargan said, we never went near the registry. Back and forth to the compound during the week of councils, Gargan on occasion said only a brief hello to Ted Kennedy. He was pointedly excluded from the strategy sessions. The senator did not feel like talking about the accident. Gargan was an embarrassment and a potential threat. To those who didn't know the real story, he was a puzzle wrapped in conspiratorial silence. But silence the senator had demanded. Gargan wouldn't talk about the reason the accident hadn't been reported for 10 hours. Because of his friendship and regard for Gargan, Paul Markham wasn't going to blow the whistle on Ted Kennedy either. Markham told reporters, I see no prospect of talking about it. Not today, not tomorrow, and not the next day. I see no necessity of talking about it ever. Markham and Gargan were given the opportunity to examine the speech of explanation Senator Kennedy was going to deliver on television. Gargan hadn't actually seen Ted Sorensen writing it, but I was of the opinion he prepared most of it. There was nothing wrong with the speech as far as Gargan and Markham were personally concerned. However, we felt that the tone of the speech, the way it was written, wasn't going to be helpful to the senator, and we didn't think he should make it, Gargan said. My main objection to the broadcast was it was totally against my training of keeping your mouth shut. Don't give your case away. Because the speech referred to his client, Joseph Donahue Jr. read over the draft.
Donahue found it acceptable with regard to Gargan's legal position, but otherwise was appalled. He urged Gargan to go personally to Ted Kennedy to dissuade him from delivering the speech. Donahue said, "Can't you get to him? Can't you tell him how damaging this is?"
"We indicated our feelings, but others had theirs," Gargan said. "It seemed to me they'd already made up their mind to go ahead with this explanation. We weren't being asked for advice at this time."
While the speech presented an accurate portrayal of the rescue effort Gargan and Markham made at Dyke Bridge, the only part of the incident in which they had played a direct part, the rest of it was a fake, Gargan said later.
"It was made up, all of it, including thoughts and emotions."
Chapter 31. Because the senator's address was regarded as a news story, all three television networks donated 15 minutes of prime time to the broadcast. Boston's WHDH-TV was selected to originate the program, an arrangement made with Harold Clancy, general manager of the station and publisher of the affiliated Boston Herald Traveler. Clancy was spotted on board the Marlin in the zoom lens of a photographer standing at the periphery of the compound, one of a crew of reporters who jeered at the huge remote truck emblazoned with Channel 5's logo that was waved through the checkpoint on Scudder Avenue. Among reporters who had stood a week's vigil waiting the release of a statement regarding the accident was Herald Traveler's stringer, Francis Broadhurst. Learning WHDH had been chosen to provide the feed for the broadcast, Broadhurst proposed he masquerade as a member of the television crew to observe firsthand the speech and write a background story. Broadhurst was outraged when Clancy vetoed the idea.
"I was pretty disillusioned that the Kennedys could exercise so much control over the press," he said. "No reporter was to be allowed inside the house. The senator wasn't going to answer any questions after his speech."
Following the remote truck in a small van was audio technician Don Moore. Assigned a crew to provide live coverage of the Miss Massachusetts beauty pageant in Attleboro, Moore had been chosen as a part of a crew of five and told, "You're going to Hyannisport." Facilities for the broadcast were to be set up at the senator's house. Moore drove to the causeway at Squaw Island, got out of the van, and measured the distance between two entrance pillars. The remote truck couldn't get through. The location of the speech was moved to the home of Ambassador Joseph P. Kennedy. The remote truck was proceeding down Marchand Lane, used by the Kennedy family and other residents, when a highly agitated man ran out of an adjacent house, demanding the caravan stop. He told Director Bob Kincaid, "You see those overhanging branches of that tree on my property? If one leaf falls, I'm suing Channel 5 for damages." To assuage the irate neighbor, Kincaid stationed two crew members on top of the remote truck to divert branches from its path. Despite such precautions, Moore observed one leaf disengage. Kincaid was able to distract the tree owner's attention as the leaf fell earthward. When it was within reach, Moore grabbed it and stuck it in his pocket. While some facilities existed from previous television coverage originating from the compound, it was a race against time to install a hookup of television lines to deliver picture and sound beamed from Cape Cod via Providence, Rhode Island, to New York, where networks would distribute the program nationwide at 7:30 p.m., when the senator was scheduled to deliver his speech. At 7:20 p.m., the crew got a picture. 5 minutes later, the audio came in. Moore was asked by CBS for a microphone test. CBS was in the midst of broadcasting the nightly news with Walter Cronkite. The program featured an interview with Dr. Donald Mills, conducted by correspondent Ben Silver, during which the medical examiner revealed the decision not to perform an autopsy on Mary Jo Kopechne had been jointly made with the district attorney's office. At the interview's conclusion, Mills received a telephone call from Edmund Denise. He said, "Mills, you let me down by not ordering an autopsy." He started to scream over the telephone about what a liar I was, how incompetent I was, and worse, Mills recalled. When he launched into a personal attack, my wife picked up the extension phone and screamed right back at him. I will not give you exactly what he said, but he was unpleasant, quite impolite, and he hung up the receiver in my face. A light layer of pancake makeup was applied to the senator's face to dull a surface reflection of lights. Kennedy asked his mother to join Stephen Smith and his sisters, Jean and Patricia, in a room off the library